Okay, let's call this 1:33 meeting of the Amador Air District Board of Directors to order. And let's see if we have a quorum. Okay. I think, are you just taking it by seeing us, or would you like to read it out loud? Or have us read, you know, say our names? Okay, please.
Frank X.
Lynn Morgan, County.
Richard Forrester, Board of Supervisors.
Munching on M&Ms.
Pat Crew, Board of Supervisors.
Robin Peters, City of Center Creek.
Bob Stimson, City of Jackson.
Great. Welcome. Hey, please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty.
Call upstairs and tell Brian. Brian, should we call him?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not sure he does.
Okay, so I will entertain a motion for approval of the agenda.
Move to approve, Madam Chair.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Please indicate by saying aye that you approve the agenda.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Agenda approved. Public matters not on the agenda. Discussion only. Any person may address the board on any issues that are not on the agenda already. And if you would like to, if it's an issue that should be referred to a later agenda, we can do that. But please note that there's a 5-minute limit per topic. Anybody? Oh.
I have a
comment. Okay.
I guess we've all been receiving an emails from Steve Q. Cannon.
Yes.
And he's concerned about not being able to burn on certain days, and I'm just wondering, can we contact Mr. Cannon and try to explain the situation?
It's under correspondence, isn't it? It's on the agenda.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize.
Yes, it is.
With the response, with our response, Frank.
Never mind.
Right. Okay. Anything else? Thank you. We'll move on to administrative matters. Review and approval of the October 17th board minutes. Are there any changes, or may I have a motion to approve?
Move to approve.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. All those in favor of approving the minutes?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. And I also say aye. Okay. Approval of meeting schedule for 2018, which is on one of these pages.
Yeah, it's election.
Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped right over that, didn't I? Yes.
Good afternoon, Jim McCargue, Air Pollution Control Officer. This is the meeting, January meeting every year, where we do the election of the chair and vice chair. And just as a reminder, this last year, 2017, Director Lynn Morgan's been serving as a chair. Prior to that, I think Director Peters was for 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. And prior to that, I know Director Crew was for 2015, and I'm not sure, you may have been the year before, but part of. Okay. So the point of all that is to just mention that in some cases we do extend to more than 1 year.
Okay. So I will entertain a motion. Do you usually take those separately or together?
I think we can take them together.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion for recommendation of chair and vice chair for 2018.
For vice chair again, is it Brian?
It is Brian.
Yes.
Seems logical to rotate Brian into the chair position, wouldn't
sure.
it?
Sure.
Wherever Brian is.
In his absence, I would nominate Brian as chair.
Who is vice chair?
Bob Stimson.
Okay. Is there a second to that motion?
I'll second.
Okay. I have a motion and a second to nominate Director Onetto as chair and Director Simpson as vice chair. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Okay. Any opposed? Okay, great.
You're no longer chair.
I'm no longer chair, and it's time for you to take over, Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay.
Stop the move.
Okay.
Oh, I'll move here.
Want me to move? Okay.
Sorry, we don't have a pedestal for that because somebody stole our pedestal and our gavel.
Stolen.
Did they really?
Yes.
Stole the gavel?
Yes. They stole both pieces.
Yeah.
Where's the janitor?
A couple of weeks ago.
$5,000 reward.
A couple of months ago.
Wow. Okay, item number three, approval of meeting schedule for 2018.
Okay, and again, this time of year, January meeting is when we approve the calendar schedule of meetings, and meetings are always the third Tuesday of the month, always held here in the board chambers, always at 1:30 p.m., and we have March 20th, May 15th, June 19th, as if needed. Often that one does get postponed if it's not needed. August 21st, October 16th, and that completes 2018, then of course going into the January meeting for 2019. So that's the schedule we have for this coming year.
Hey, do we have a motion?
I will move approval of the 2018 meeting schedule.
Second.
Motion by Len Morgan and second by Pat Crewe. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Passes. Do we need public comment?
I would just ask.
Oh, I'm not sure. Okay. On the meeting schedule, probably not.
Okay. Next item, rules update, presentation by Mr. Ray Kapai.
Did his handout go around, Herminia? We've got a handout that Ray's going to present off of in just a moment. And just as a little background information, at our last October 17th, 2017 meeting, an ad hoc committee was formed to meet and discuss the rules update progress in Director Peters was unable to attend, but myself and Director Morgan met with Mr. Kapai and discussed the rules update, the budget expended, and the work product received. Then I've listed a few, kind of a some of the summary of some of the steps that have occurred over the last several years. But primarily today, Mr. Ray Kapai will come up and discuss his presentation. Ray?
Good afternoon. So let's go to the first slide. Put together some key talking points. What I'd like to talk about today is the background to the air quality rules and exactly what are district's obligations. The overall timeline, up to date, what have we been doing, what have we achieved. Just a quick review of the proposed changes to current district rules. What still needs to be completed, and then finally the budget status. How much have we spent? How much money do we still have left? And how much more money do we need? Right. So next slide. Okay. The background to the air quality rules and regulations. Essentially, the way the process works is that the federal government enacts some rules and regulations under the Clean Air Act, and then tells the states to go ahead and take these rules and regulations and enforce them on behalf of the federal government. In most states, the state handles the air quality regulations. In California, however, the state decided they really didn't want to do that, so they pushed the regulations and the enforcement of those regulations down to the counties or air districts. So what that means is that essentially the burden of understanding, applying, and complying with all those rules is shifted to each air district or each county. Next slide. A key metric, which is how we are judged, is the quality of the air around us. Typically, the main standard which is used are the ambient air quality standards, and the probably can't see that, but in your handout you can probably see, for example, the top one is ozone. We have a California standard and we have a state standard, and essentially we are required to comply with that standard. So if the air quality or if the concentration of pollutants is higher than that, then we're told that we're not in compliance with the law and that we better get our act together or else. But that's the key metric that's used. One of the challenges is that, you know, the air quality depends not just on stationary sources, which is what the air district regulates, but it also depends on air emissions from cars, trucks, buses. And the regulation of those emissions is at the state level. And in a county like Amador, the bulk of our air emissions come from cars. So imagine this, that we're going to be held to this standard. Our hands are going to be tied behind our back because we can't really do anything about the main sources of air pollution. But if the standard is exceeded, then we get threatening emails and letters saying that, oh my God, you better do something. A very difficult and a very challenging situation.
But doesn't most of our ozone come from Sacramento?
Yes, some of it is transported from Sacramento, and some of it is cars and trucks, which leave the emissions, which also results in ozone. That's true.
Here in the county?
I think in the county it is, but the way the transport regulations are written, you have to meet some really key metrics before they'll allow you to claim that this is not your fault, it was all transport. I had looked into that at length, and we did not qualify. But that's a good question. But many counties in the same boat, for example, Mariposa, Calaveras, very similar, where really you don't have a lot of industry. You have a lot of cars, and you have a lot of transport. So, for example, being right next to the San Joaquin Valley Air District, Sacramento, Placer, those are much, much larger counties, and a lot of their emissions, because the air goes from the west to the east, the emissions basically are moved towards the mountains, and you know, we're stuck with it. But anyway, nobody said it's fair, but that's just how it is. Next slide. This is a quick map showing you on the handout that you have at the very last page or towards the end. I've completed a whole map here, which is the ARB. What they do is they look at the entire state and then put these check marks on places that violate the ozone standard. In the case of Amador, there's kind of a little yellow, a white spot, and we are considered non-attainment slash, is it incomplete? What's the term they use? Unclassified. So we, you know, we're not in non-attainment, according to these maps. And these maps are generated every year by the California Air Resources Board. And as I said, these maps really do not care where the emissions came from. If your monitoring station shows that you exceeded the standard, you get to be in those black spots, and that's just how it goes. All right, next slide. I started taking a look at the rulemaking. I've been working for the district for about 15 years, and back in 2010, Mike Boitano, some of you may remember, was the APCO. And I told Mike, you know, some of our regulations and rules in the county went into effect in 1976. And And I said, you know, I think maybe we should just take a look at those and see if we can update them. And there were some revisions back in 2009. But all in all, the rules that we follow in our permitting and everything are, you know, 30 plus years old. And Mike Bortana said, well, that's fine. Tell me what we need to do. And I put together a little memo, and I said, you know, here's all the rules that I think we should at least start and start looking at these. And he said, hey, that's very good. But really nothing was done for a couple of years. I mean, it wasn't really a priority. So we kind of poked at it, spent some time on some memos, did a little bit of research, but really, you know, nothing was done till 2013. And in 2013, two things happened. Number one, that the standards for ozone dropped from 75 to 70 parts per billion. So all of a sudden, several air districts became non-attainment. So even though your air quality hasn't changed, but the standard has changed. It's more stringent. So all of a sudden, yesterday you were in compliance, and today you're not in compliance. And the second thing that happened was that under President Obama, he said that, you know, we're going to regulate greenhouse gases, and greenhouse gas emissions is going to be one of the air pollutants. And that set off a panic because none of the air districts and counties have regulations for greenhouse gas. To make matters worse, some of the counties which were previously in attainment all of a sudden became non-attainment. Amador was lucky that we dodged the bullet, that we were still attainment even under the more stringent standard, but just by a hair. It could go either way, but we managed to stay under the standard. But it was decided that, you know, since we are right at the ragged edge, we really need to be prepared that if, you know, next year all of a sudden we're in non-attainment, we have to develop a new rule. You know, we should have something in the books in place so that very quickly we can, you know, promulgate and implement those rules.
As far as so, greenhouse, you know, gases, is it just carbon dioxide, or is it the whole list of?
It's a whole list. It's a list of about 30 gases.
So methane would also.
Methane, nitrous oxide, a lot of the fluorocarbons, CFCs. It's a really long laundry list of things that you know previously didn't exist, but all of a sudden these new air pollutants we were told that we, you know, had to regulate. And at that time, you know, I was asked, well, you know, to do all this, what is it going to cost and who's going to do it? I had proposed a budget of about $21,000 at that time. And let me tell you, that was really it was my best guess. I really did not know what it would cost. And the reason is that, really, we don't have staff at the district to make rules. I mean, I'm a chemical engineer. I handle permits. I handle air pollution. But I'm not a rule developer. So, next slide, please. So we decided that maybe what we should do is talk to some of the other air districts who have staff that do rulemaking and maybe kind of piggyback on what they're doing and to see if they could help us develop these rules. So in 2013, we reached out to the San Joaquin Valley Air District and the Placer County Air District on assisting us and, more important, guiding us to make sure that do we really need these rules, and if we do, what is it that needs to be in the content of the rules? Because as I said, you know, at the district level, certainly none of us really knew what was the best way for us to proceed. So staff from these districts visited us here. We had several meetings, and we went over what exactly is going to be in the rule. And then staff from these districts prepared two sets of rules. One was the greenhouse gas rule, The other one was for the new source review rule, which has to do with if we become non-attainment for ozone, then we need to have that new source review rule, rule number 401. And as far as the other district rules, we really didn't do a whole lot. We kind of focus on, because this seemed to be the more urgent of the thing, so we spent a lot of our time and money on those two rules. And finally, in 2017, I resurrected that we should go back to the other district rules and update those as well. And so last year, I worked on developing and updating those rules. Next slide. The process of updating the district rules essentially is very simple. We go through our rules, you know, 200 plus pages, identify the rules we think need to be updated, research the federal and state regulation to see what else needs to be in there, what needs to be updated. Finally, look at what other districts do, how did they develop them. I'm a firm believer in not having to reinvent the wheel. If somebody else has already developed some of this stuff, let's use it. Why start from scratch? And then finally, with all that, we created a document. I call it the red line document, which had changes of the rules that I thought should be done. And just to make sure we have a reality check after we did that, I sent those redlined rules to Sacramento Metro Air District. They have a big staff on rulemaking. And I said, listen, I want you to just check this to see, does this make sense? Did we forget something? Is there something in there that doesn't have to be there? Of course, we have to pay them. But they did comment, and one of their senior managers, I put him as a subcontractor myself. And so we got comments back from them. And so the final red line version that I handed over to Jim has SAC Metro's comments as well. And finally, once all that's done, we essentially do in-house review of the rules and decide, you know, what's next. Next slide. In your packet, in that handout I gave you towards the end, is kind of a listing of some of the rules by rule number, some of the changes that are proposed. You can't see the slide, but I've attached something at the back. You can see that. I did not bother attaching the 200-page document, but a copy is available from Jim, which shows the actual verbiage and text changes that we're proposing. And I think the next one is about the same, Jim. Yeah, and one more? Yeah, okay. And then what's the last one? Okay. So what still needs to be done? Well, essentially all the work has already been completed. The only thing that's left now is that we have to prepare a staff report explaining the rule changes that we're proposing. And after that, we essentially distribute these rules, proposed rules, to the public. They have a 30-day comment period. And then after that, usually everybody has a, there's a board meeting, the public comments on the proposed rules, the board discusses the proposed rules, and then decides whether to adopt them or not adopt them. And if they decide to adopt them, then we send those over to the ARB and EPA to say this is formally now part of our rules. And that's how the process ends. So bulk of the work is already been done, but some of this stuff is going to take another probably 3 months, and that still needs to be done. One question that I ask is, well, what happens if we don't adopt the rules? I mean, why bother? Let's just hope the whole thing goes away. I mean, that'd be nice. Well, our neighbor to the south did that. And lo and behold, they were contacted by the EPA. And one of the things that happened was that several environmental groups had filed a notice to intent or some that they were going to file lawsuits and sue the county and the EPA for violating the Clean Air Act. As you can imagine, once those emails came, everybody got pretty excited, and we said we better address this immediately. And so last September to November, we updated their rules, got everything through that we've done here, the last year or two. We did it over there like in 4 months. Got everything through, approved, and to ARB, and the people who are going to sue the county went away. Let me tell you one other important point that I should have mentioned earlier. I had mentioned that Amador County had managed to dodge the bullet, that we were just below the threshold for ozone. Well, our luck ran out last year, and we had not one but three ozone violations. So now, was it four?
Yeah, four.
Four. And so I expect now that ARB and EPA eventually are going to be contacting us and saying, oh, by the way, do you have this new source review rule ready? Which, since we already have, we can say, yes, it's ready to go. Needs some minor tweaking. Take a look, and we're set to go. On the greenhouse gas rule, it turned out because of political pressure, they decided that the greenhouse gas really was not a pollutant and that they weren't going to require the districts to enforce greenhouse gas regulation. And then after that, of course, the change in the, you know, to the Republicans, and President Trump doesn't believe in global warming or greenhouse gas, so he's barred the EPA and everybody never to use the word global warming. So I don't think the greenhouse gas rule is going to go anywhere anytime soon. It may come back, but as far as I see it, that was effort we spent a lot of time on, for which really we have nothing to show for. We did it, but then the politics changed. But if it comes back, then certainly we do have it.
So if we're in violation of ozone, did this occur on like four separate days?
It was four separate days. It was a Jackson monitoring station.
What do we have to do then to comply, or what can we do?
Okay, what we have to do is that the current district rules are very, shall we say, lax. We allow companies to come and set up shop here without really mitigating those emissions, unless they are very, very large companies. So, for example, in most air districts, if you put out more than 10 tons per year of some pollutants, which is quite a bit, you know, you're supposed to use best available control technology. You're supposed to do best management practices, you know, good housekeeping to minimize emissions. In Amador, our number is 100 tons before they have to reduce emission, which means we're like a magnet to invite polluting industries to our region. So why would somebody want to go to San Joaquin if they can come here and you know, save all that money on air pollution equipment? They can just, you know. So that's the problem. So what we're going to do is that new source review rule that we developed, that one of the things it does, it lowers the threshold for what is a major source down from 100 to about 25 tons a year. It also requires much more stringent monitoring. Also, if you emit above and beyond a certain amount, it requires you to offset those emissions by cleaning up the emissions somewhere else. So it's a much more robust and more stringent approach to allowing people to come in to Amador.
Curious. Oh,
sure.
What kind of industries, real quick, create a lot of ozone then, besides...
Typically, the ozone-producing industry, they come in two categories. Anybody that burns a lot of fuel, combustion sources, natural gas, are high emitters. The other ones are anybody that uses a lot of coatings, solvents, organic liquids, for example, asphalt, for example. Anybody that does a lot of that would cause, you know, really it's the organics and then oxides and nitrogen from combustion are the two precursors to ozone. Ozone is not emitted from a tailpipe, it's created, it's a secondary pollutant. So this rule puts limits on, you know, if you have so many organic compound, you know, then we're going to ask you to reduce those emissions, not at 100 tons per year, but at 25. And we're going to tell you what we consider best available control technology is.
When you say tons, are you talking physical tons or figurative tons or what?
Tons. 2,000 pounds is one ton, yeah.
How do you measure that?
For gases and stuff, typically we measure for, let's say you have a smokestack with stuff coming up. We measure that usually in terms of concentration of the pollutant, say parts per million of NOx, parts per million of carbon monoxide. And then by knowing the temperature and the flow rate of the gas, we can convert that to a mass unit, pounds per hour, in terms of what's coming out. So you can go from a concentration to a mass unit by knowing the flow rate of what's coming out. So basically,
theoretically, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's
mathematically
standard. Yeah, those are standard test procedures that EPA has promulgated that we follow. So if somebody is going to be emitting this much, usually now under the new rule, we will require that they actually conduct source tests to measure and confirm that they didn't go over the limits that.
And if they're gas, oh, sorry.
So you heard that we had a complaint from someone that overburning, and it was this last 3-day weekend. But those recommendations come from the state, and the reason they make those is because of things like the inversion layer and other things that hold the gases down. Is that right?
Yeah, the way that the burn or no burn decision is based on what's called the ventilation rate of the atmosphere. In other words, if you have a fair amount of breeze that's going to blow the smoke away, then that would mean that's a burn day. On the other hand, if you have stagnant winds, low inversion, low wind speeds, that means that the pollution is going to accumulate, then that would be a no-burn day. I point out, in either case, both of those emissions contribute to ozone. The ozone doesn't distinguish between burn or no-burn day. That's something we've put in as a convenience to, you know, our community. When you burn wood, you create oxides of nitrogen and you create organics, both of which are precursors to ozone.
I think we have a talk about the budget. Summary. Okay, so we developed the greenhouse gas rule, which I think doesn't need to go anywhere. I think we'll just put it in our back pocket. Rule 401, I think I'm recommending that it should be adopted, although we haven't been, you know, formally warned. I think that's coming. I think we should update our rules and recommend adoption. Let me give you a simple example of our current rules and why the district is very vulnerable to lawsuits. One of the pollutants that we're supposed to regulate is PM2.5. That doesn't exist in our rules. So even if you ignore the greenhouse gas rule or the NSR rule, that puts the district, makes the district very vulnerable to lawsuit, because they're saying, wait a minute, you're supposed to enforce a Clean Air Act. That is a regulated pollutant, and you don't even have it in your regulations. We don't advertise that, obviously, but you can see it puts the district, makes it vulnerable, you know, to some, you know, mostly environmental groups. I mean, the EPA and ARB know all this. And they're cool with it. They say, that's fine. Just get to it when you do. They're not going to sue us or fine us. It's the other environmental groups who see it as an opportunity, you know, to shake us down, get money, et cetera, et cetera. That's where we have to be, careful about. So.
You probably don't know, but I'm curious how big a risk that is. In other words, would you, in your professional opinion, recommend that we work on that rule?
I would say that if we did not have the non-attainment of ozone, I would say the risk would be low, because that situation has been there for 5+ years and nobody's really bothered us. But now that we're non-attainment, that is advertised in the Federal Register. So every environmental group says, aha. And then you get into their crosshairs. Whereas had that not happened, they would probably, leave us alone. I,
I think that's why when we first started this thing, nothing really happened for many years, because there really wasn't any sense of urgency that, you know, had to be done now, and it wasn't a priority. But now that I think that since we're non-attainment, focus is definitely going to shift on us. And I can tell you that people will be watching. So it does increase our risk. Yeah, one more. Okay, here's a rough budget for what we started with. I said earlier, $21,000 was roughly my guess. Of that, we handed most of that money to the San Joaquin Valley and Placer County Air Districts. It was $15,000, and that was spent back in 2013. So that left us around $6,000 from 2013 to now to, finish the regulations, current rule update. I said earlier that I think we would like to have another $2,500. I think Jim indicated that. Is there any budget left of that 21?
There is, yeah.
Maybe. Because if we have budget left, then we may not need to.
So how much?
What it results is I have a remaining budget, $4,762.80.
Oh, okay.
And that's based upon the yellow highlights that you're looking at is the amount spent since approval of that budget in April of 2013.
Okay.
And that total is $16,237.20.
Okay, so that my numbers are a bit off.
A little bit off.
I thought we had spent
yeah.
more than that. So we have. So really, we don't need any additional. Because I only need about $2,500 from what you're saying. You've got about $4,000 plus.
All right.
So I guess we don't need any more money. We still have money left in the budget. But that's roughly is where we are. Bulk of the money, as I said, was spent. We had to pay staff at San Joaquin and Placer. We have three members working on these rules for us. Copies of the rules were sent to Jim as deliverables. Now, one thing that I think Ms. Peters, somebody had asked that, hey, where's all the deliverables, right? And it seemed to me that when we produce all these rules and the work products, they were sent to the APCO, but somehow I don't think that was communicated to the board. So we spent all this money in the dark, and you're wondering, where's all this money going? What did we get for our money? And I think that was not communicated to you at the time. But hopefully, in my talk today, that you have a clearer picture of what we did and where the money was spent. So.
I'm sorry. Can you tell us about the time frame that you see from here forward? Clearly, there's money in the budget. Jim's confirmed that you've delivered the product. Needs to go to ARB and EPA for review. When can that happen? You have a staff report to prepare. When will that be done? One of my biggest frustrations is that this has taken so long.
Sure.
So I want to get it wrapped up. We have money left in the budget. That's a good thing. So let's get it finished. How quickly can we do that?
I think the best way to answer that is I'm going to reach out to the ARB first, because now we're non-attainment. Let's find out exactly what it is that they're expecting from us to make sure that the new source review rule gets adopted and accepted by them.
That's a question I have, because say we go ahead and do this new source rule and all that, it's not our pollutants, I don't believe, causing the problems. I'd say it's probably San Joaquin, Sacramento blowing in here. So we're probably, I guess we'll probably have even more non-attainment if they build more houses in Folsom, Ranch Marietta, more businesses.
Yeah, that's true, but I looked into the transport issue, and we are not qualifying to claim that.
Why not?
There's some recipe they use as to how far you are from certain developments, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have the details with me, but I did take a look at that. In fact, Jim had brought up that question, and we had researched that. Believe me, that is what that would have been the best outcome, that that you know, we're basically a victim of all this, but there's some specific numbers and you have to follow, and if you follow that recipe, we don't qualify. But I did go through that, and I can resurrect that and provide that to the product that to Jim, and he can forward.
And I guess a follow-up question is, where is are these air samples taken? Is that DMV or somewhere like that? Is that one of the stations, as I remember?
No, I think this one is in Jackson. Is that Clinton Street?
Yeah, that's the same one.
I mean, that's
out there. Clinton and Broadway on the corner of the DMV building, right?
That's right. That's,
it seems like a bad place if you want to be taking a like a relative sample.
Very bad place. I think there should be a wide area that's sampled.
Yeah, you should be 3-4 samples if we could. Different areas.
It doesn't give a complete overall picture of the county.
No, not at all.
Spot.
I just wanted to finish my response to Robin.
Okay.
I think that we can produce a staff report and send these rules out for public comment within 30 days. There's really nothing. We can send copies to ARB. And so I think at this point, there's really, I mean, all the work's already been done. I see no reason for wait since we already have the budget. So within 30 days, we can produce a staff report, send out a public notice, put out proposed rule changes on our website so people can look at them. And then 30 days after that, the public, you know, the comment period is up. The board can at that time decide, hey, yeah, we'd like to adopt this or no. And after that, we basically send it to the ARB and say, here's the work product. So I don't see it, you know, more than about 2.5 months. I think, because I think if we don't have something like this in place, I don't want to get an email or a phone call from EPA saying the same two environmental groups are now after us. And I want to have this in place and say the district has done all this work, already completed. Here's the public noticing, and that takes care of it. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
So what would the new rules, how would they affect existing businesses that might be ozone polluters and future businesses?
First of all, it would not affect existing businesses.
So
but it does affect new businesses who come in. We ask them to use the best available control technology and minimize emissions. But it doesn't affect anybody who's here right now.
Unless you do probably maybe a change in operations.
If you do a modification, then any new emissions that you generate would be subject to the rule. But any existing operation would not.
How many other counties have adopted the greenhouse rule 525?
The only ones that I know are South Los Angeles and San Francisco. None of the others did. They just said, well, you know, if it's not a pollutant, why regulate? Because the problem is that if you start regulating these pollutants that nobody agrees on, you're just subject to lawsuits. People say, wait a minute, why am I being asked to regulate this thing when the Fed has said it's not a pollutant?
But what about state statute? Because the state has its own...
The state has been pretty numb as far as stationary sources go. The state has been putting a lot of heat on greenhouse gas, not from a permitting standpoint, but operationally, if you already are operating a refinery, the state is saying, because you're putting out these greenhouse gases, we want those emissions offset under greenhouse gas rules, but nothing to do with air pollution permits. So they did kind of an end run and to, you know, to do that. Now, greenhouse gas emissions are still regulated, let's say if a new facility comes in. Under CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act, their greenhouse gas regulations do exist. So we do have to look at greenhouse gas emissions from cars and trucks and sources under the EIR process, but not under the district permitting process.
I just don't want to put a target on our back from the state. I mean, we have four violations now for attainment, and that's what the state does. They're doing it to ARSA right now, or our Regional Sanitation Authority, where they focus on one entity and just keep hitting them and hitting them. I just don't want to put a target on our back.
Well, the way I see that, to prevent that, I think it's for us to be proactive. Instead of being told do this, I think we should proactively say, hey, we're going to go out and promote, you know, go after and adopt these rules without state or EPA, you know, telling us. And the rules, by the way, that we developed here, I looked at the rules for just about every other air district to make sure that the rules we're offering are the most streamlined, the bare minimum, which are needed for us to do the job. The new source review and a rule in the Bay Area is four times the size of what we're proposing. Because I just feel that you know, why kill a flea with a sledgehammer? Our problem here is mostly transport and cars and stuff like that. Our problem is not stationary sources. But we have to go through the motions of saying, yeah, we're being good boys and girls. Look at what we've done.
The on the attainment and non-attainment, you said we had four violations in 17 and strongly suggests that we may be designated as non-attainment. Four violations in what? Out of 365 days?
Yeah.
And four is a lot?
Yeah.
Not in my book.
Well, that's 8,760 hours. So four out of that is enough to kick you in. They'll allow one or two. But once you start to getting the third and fourth, then
I think you could argue that third and fourth is arbitrary and capricious. It should be 9 and 10. What's right and wrong there?
Yeah. What the ARB does, because this comes up all the time, they say, well, you know, that was a bad day. We had a forest fire. It was unusual weather conditions. So that is not typical. So what ARB does, they look at the data, and they issue what's called a clean data finding. Now, if they determine that, hey, that was an outlier, then, well, that's good. Then, you know, but if we had four outliers, we're off the hook. But I doubt that'll happen. But they do go through that to make sure that the data is clean and representative before they ask us to, you know, do anything.
But you had a lot of fires last year, too, and their air is just really just ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, that is often taken into account.
You know, I'd like to go back to see Jim's there. Maybe we go back to those, that monitoring station there off Clinton, I think around the DMV office somewhere in there. I mean, I don't think it's a real representative sample of air quality in Amador County.
Yeah, and I can dig up the information we brought together. It's been a couple years now that we looked at the rural transport exemption, and Ray's right. We had Ray involved, and we were in extended conversations with the Air Resources Board. And essentially, as I recall, what they were saying is, well, guys, what you would have to do is you would have to put monitors right on the border of your county, the western border, so that San Joaquin-Sacramento border, right, to be able to show that you've got higher levels there than what you have up within your county, the bulk of your county. And so that can be a tricky proposition. As a matter of fact, one of the Northern California counties, I think, added an extra monitor because they wanted one on top of Sutter Buttes, was it? Sutter Buttes. And they thought, this is great, on top of Sutter Buttes, we're going to get great, clean. That kicked them into non-attainment, that extra monitor. So sometimes it can come back and bite you.
So they were trying to show that upwind pollution is much worse than downwind, and therefore that supports the argument about transport. Yeah, and also you'd have to do it over many years, because if you just do it for 1 year and it's a bad year, the results could go either way. So
so it's something we can bring back out and take a look at, but we did really pretty thoroughly pursue that option of rural transport.
Well, question on it. You're saying somebody put an extra monitor and that kicked them into non-attainment.
Right.
Well, what about we put in another monitor somewhere, and that may take put us into attainment?
Into attainment, and perhaps that could be the case. But
for that to happen, what you'd have to show is that the upwind monitor had much higher concentration of ozone than the ozone within your county on a 1 or 2 year time span. And if you could show consistently every time the wind is blowing this way, the emissions, the concentration of ozone is higher here than, let's say, on Clinton Street, then that supports your argument that, hey, it's all transport. But if we find out that the upwind monitor is the same or slightly lower, well, now we've just hung ourselves with our own rope, because now we've clearly shown it's us. Whereas previously there was some doubt whether we were us, but now that data clearly points a finger. So it's a double-edged sword, but I would say, given the fact that we only have a single monitor, and it's, you know, monitoring is very time-consuming, very expensive, and open to all kinds of judgment, I would say, right, just bite the bullet, put in an updated regulation, and let new companies coming in do their part to clean the emissions, and I think the problem goes away. Otherwise, you haven't reduced any emissions, and I think that's what we want.
Why can't we just compare what our monitor is picking up with somebody else's monitor to the west of us, rather than putting our own another one of our own in?
The reason is that it's hard to interpret, you know, how do you compare what's over there, and the distance is so great, it's hard to tell. How do you apportion the ozone that's on Clinton Street didn't come from there? There's too many questions, and we can't really answer that and say it definitely, you know, it came from there. We'd love to do that, but it's difficult. There's too many other unknowns creep in.
So what are the determining factors as to where your monitoring is done?
Typically, the monitor, before you set up a monitor,
just have a single monitor.
Yeah, the way you set up a monitor is that EPA and ARB has certain monitor siting guidelines. The monitor cannot be located any near any known sources of emissions that you're trying to measure. So if you want to, let's say, measure lead, don't put a monitor near a lead smelter. It's common sense. Similarly, you don't want to put a PM10 monitor close to a quarry. But ozone is a little bit different, and that is that the place where the emissions that make ozone occur is not where the highest ozone happens. So, for example, in the Bay Area, Livermore has very high ozone concentrations, but the bulk of the emissions are in Contra Costa and Richmond. So it's tricky to, when you're citing ozone monitors, you know, where, but I'm sure ARB went through this exercise and concluded that, hey, this would be okay for ozone. It would not be okay for carbon monoxide or dust.
And Pat, you're up next.
Jim, if I remember right, too, didn't we ask just to move the monitor to the Blue Shield building? Or we discussed doing that. Eric, did I just dream that up? Because we thought it would give us a better prevailing wind and...
Well, Matt with the Air District, Matt Peterson. You guys have reviewed this before.
Yeah,
And you're kind of going along the same guidelines. But I remember that pretty much at the end of all this, you determined that it was good just to have that one monitor here in Jackson and not develop any more monitors that the state places, not us, we don't decide. And then they control it, because then they're, like Ray's saying, there's more information. So when that was presented, I can't remember when it was a couple of years ago, yeah, that it was decided upon review that you thought, well, it's best that we just keep it status quo and not make any changes and, you know, kind of deal with what we get.
That was prior to 4 violations, right? That discussion occurred before we...
We're going to do... I mean, we're trending. I think we're improving also. Because the transport, what we're getting down below, they're improving. So hopefully we see, you know, a benefit from that, you know, down the road in a couple of years.
But the ozone standard we're talking about, it's not a 1-hour standard, it's an 8-hour standard. So there has to be a sustained period of high ozone concentration for us to kick in. Now, the state of California also has a one-hour ozone standard, but and you know we've been blowing past that for the last 10 years. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the federal 8-hour ozone standard.
Mr. Chairman, in the interest of moving forward, I have a procedural question. This is agendized as a presentation.
Possible action.
As I see it, board made the decision to pursue a rules update years ago, and we're at the end point, finally. We have budget left. The work product is done. We just need to go into distribution mode and review. Is there any action to be taken today, or can we look at today's presentation as an update of where we are and with consensus of the board just stay the course until we're done? Is that the way you see this, Jim?
Certainly.
Do you see any new action necessary?
Certainly. I was thinking, you know, depending, again, those numbers, that sheet I showed you, you can look at them a couple different ways. So I wanted to be covered both ways. But if we look at them strictly based upon those yellow highlights, we do have budget. We are moving forward. And we have a plan. And I think if there's consensus from this board, we can continue on with the path that Ray has outlined for us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any, I'm going to ask member public. Any members of the public like to comment? With that, I think we have a consensus of the board, and we'll go ahead, keep going ahead.
Finish the process.
Finish the process, and I just wanted to just reiterate, Ray. So what we have now in the next month, we'll send to ARB, and we'll have them review it. And then our next meeting here is in March, so we should be able to come back in March. And is that when we would set the 30-day
time? No, I'd like to set the 30-day before that. Why wait till March? I mean, since the work product is already done, I think as Robin was saying, I don't see the need to delay. I would say that let's send it to the ARB for comments and to the public at the same time. Why?
Sure.
Yeah, I don't see the.
Yeah. I just wasn't sure if it needed to be a formal action of this board to do the 30-day.
No, not yet. So what I'm saying is that if we can do that, then in March we will already have passed the 30-day period, and public can comment at that meeting. The board can say yay or nay, and frankly, we're done. I prefer that than kind of dragging it on.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's the right approach.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. I think we got clear direction on that. Thank you, Ray.
Oh. Ania, turn the lights on.
With that, I guess we'll move on down to item number 5, Jim.
Yes.
Electric vehicle charging stations.
Okay, yes. And number 5, this was discussed at our last meeting, October 17th, 2017, and there was direction given to staff, and I've got a list of things that we did as follow-up. A letter was mailed to each incorporated city, and follow-up visits were made in person regarding the city's interest in electric vehicle charging station grant program. We also followed up with Calaveras County Air Pollution Control District to determine electric vehicle charging station options on the Highway 4 corridor. Personal visits have been made to Imperial Hotel, Castle Oaks Golf Course, Amador Council of Tourism, the Hotel in Rancho Murrieta, Island Plaza Market, Taste Restaurant, and the Amador County Transportation Commission. Then next, the Air Pollution Control Officer is scheduled to make a presentation to the Chamber of Commerce this Friday at 8:30 a.m. Regarding this program. And then lastly, Tesla has been contacted regarding their partners program, where they provide a dual Tesla with a traditional charger at no cost to select businesses. And I just got some feedback from Tesla today. So this is kind of updated and new news that I wanted to share with you. And Tesla responded to my inquiry by saying, We have two different programs when it comes to charging. One being destination charging, which is intended to serve properties with longer dwell times, such as parking garage, restaurants, retail, hospitality, and more. The other is our supercharger program, which is a completely different product that we would look to install along frequented travel routes to support long-distance travel within your county. For the destination charging program, we would work with the city and or the county properties as well as private ones to determine if the properties would meet the requirements for their program. So this tells me that...
What was the second one again?
The second program is the supercharger program. The first one is destination charging, and the second one is supercharger.
I would think if someplace like Volcano Telephone has a sufficient energy, maybe we could get them to do a supercharger program. We were talking about one in Pine Grove area.
Right, right. And I did meet or talk with Maureen Funk at the Council of Tourism, and she had suggested Dan's Coffee House, CPU Computers, Finesse Floors, Pine Grove Market, Pioneer IGA, Pearl's Restaurant, and then also some Lake Comanche North Shore as a possibility. So we immediately got feedback and response from Amador City, Sutter Creek, and Ione, and they have an interest in a possible grant program. So the way I presented this is for us to proceed with a pilot project for those three cities. Now, again, I just got this information from Tesla, so I think that the way we could do this is we could pursue it, this pilot project, but utilizing the Tesla program as a first option if it's available. If it's not available, then I would suggest the pilot project as I have it outlined here, 100% purchase and installation up to $5,000. For the grantee with a total budget of $15,000 for at least this immediate pilot project. But again, pursuing Tesla first.
Paying for the electricity for the actual charging?
What's that?
Who's paying for the electricity on the actual charging at these pilot stations?
Well, the ones that I'm proposing is that the recipient, the person who's going to have the charger, would pay for it.
So they'll swipe their credit card or something? Or?
Yeah. Well, either the business... Or they'll have individual, yeah.
But if they qualify for Tesla, they get it for free, basically.
The electricity?
No, not the electricity, the installation.
Yes, but I think Director Axe was referring to the electricity.
Yeah, the actual electric, because that was always the source of contention in the past.
Yeah, Mark Berkner
that
with...
That hasn't changed.
Yeah, that hasn't changed.
Mark Berkner with Taste said that the... electricity that's charged is very minimal, and we could get that too, but it's a minimal, and they look at it as well worth it to get the business coming their direction.
But and they paid for their own installation, and no, they didn't.
Well, you're talking about Tesla?
I'm talking about Taste.
Oh, they did.
Oh, they called. They found out about it through. I don't know. He heard about it or read about it. So he actually went on the website. The applications are there. He applied, and I think they were approved for two. One Tesla, which is it only takes a Tesla. It has a Tesla port, and then they have a second one that the company, they contract with a company that comes in and puts them in for free.
Clipper Creek, I think. Is it Clipper Creek? Yeah. Clipper Creek is the traditional, you know, charger. And so Tesla will put in a dual one that has both Tesla and Clipper Creek. And I believe Taste became one of the Tesla partners.
Okay.
Go to all these meetings at night, and sometimes they pay off with a little nugget here and there.
You know, at this time, I'd like to ask for our members of the public like to comment. Is there any? I'll see you then.
Merv, they make pickups with that are electrical charge pickups.
Well, what's the pleasure of the board?
I have a couple of questions for Jim.
Okay.
Is the target, and I'm trying to recall our last conversation on the matter, target is not specifically municipal installations, is it? In other words, an installation in a, like in Jackson, where it's in the city civic center parking lot, that isn't necessarily, or this program as you envision it, isn't necessarily limited to that, is it?
No, you're absolutely correct. So it would be open, for example, for Amador City. I think Imperial Hotel was the possible spot for it. So whatever the city's, I think, desire would be, if the city has a place, a perfect place for it that would work, we'd go that direction. If the city says, hey, go to this hotel, we'd go there and see if we can.
You just touched on my next question. If the city and three other potential sites show up at the Air District at the same time, I would think that the municipal installation should have some preference. The city of Sutter Creek were to come to the Air District and want to convert one of the parking spaces in their existing city-owned lot to an electric vehicle charging station, I would think that would should take precedent over a private party who wants an installation at their hotel, for example.
Right. And
I would want to make sure that the program is set up so that the municipality has first shot at it.
That's right. And that's the way I perceive the pilot project to go, is that we will be primarily coordinating with the city. So if the city says, hey, we've got a perfect spot right here next to our city baseball field or whatever it is, we would go that direction. And before we went out to private businesses, we would ask the city, who do you suggest we talk to? What do you think is a good location outside of city property? But yes, the city would be first priority.
Well, I think you can work in coordination with the private businesses, though, because IOWN may want them, but next to City Hall may not be the ideal location, and they may not have room for it. If you worked with the city working with IOWN Plaza Market, where there's a lot of room, they could work symbiotically.
No, I agree with that.
Right.
You take Amador City, Robin. There's not a how many places that are, quote, city in Amador City could you put one?
You misunderstood what I said. The city needs to have first crack at it. As Jim pointed out, if the city realizes that it, you know, municipally owned facilities just don't present as good an opportunity for one of these charging stations as some private lot, then that's fine.
Right.
But I want to make sure that the municipality has first shot at it if they have the right spot.
Okay, you're not saying...
If the Amador City Council says that the Imperial Hotel is the best spot for it,
absolutely,
let's go for it.
Absolutely.
So that would be...
But the city's in control of that conversation.
Yeah, I think we understood what you said. You want Sutter Creek to have the first crack at it.
You're absolutely right.
My concern would be that if it goes to a private business and they restrict it to only their customers, as opposed to a public place where anybody could use it,
that'd be a problem. No, I'd agree. If it's at a private business and they have no restriction, then I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Are there any rules saying that they have to allow anybody to use it?
Or is the city council approved it?
Only white people from Norway. I think anybody has access to it.
And we don't have that specified right now, at least in our outline of the program. But my initial thought was that it would be open to whoever came.
That probably should be spelled out as part of the pilot project, if you're going to go to that. But first you're going to go to Tesla.
Right.
Right?
First the Tesla.
And you're not sure what their requirements are?
I just got an initial response today, but I will get more information.
Okay, great.
Tesla charging, their charging stations work with any other electric car or just Tesla?
Their Teslas are just for the Tesla, but they have these dual ones where they have a Tesla and a Clipper Creek. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I guess the question I'd have is we're looking at maybe doing this pilot project. What is this project in competition with? Would it be as far as a pine needle bin program, as far as maybe updating equipment for, you know, the cities, county, or something like that, or private parties? So this money, where else could it be going?
We have the budget for the city county agency diesel engine replacement. That budget was set, and this would not take away from any of those programs. This would be standalone on its own.
Well, no, I understand that, but maybe you could augment those programs if we didn't do this.
Certainly, if the decision was to not go electric vehicle charging station, then there would be an option to do something else.
I remember somebody had some numbers that showed how much they're used in El Dorado, and I don't think they're used that much, as I recall. I mean, if you had the right spot, they might be, but a lot of somebody had a handout. I think, was it Robin, Dominic? Somebody had a handout that showed maybe you had it, Jim, that showed the amount of the station, like in El Dorado or somewhere, and they weren't used much.
I think we're looking forward, right? Trying to put our toe in the pool of the future. Who was it, Frank, that you brought? I can't remember. Somebody brought some statistics to us that suggested that electric vehicle usage in California is going to dramatically increase very, very soon. I think that's what we're looking at, is get these in place.
Well, I know the state
with one eye on the future.
Gas law is really focused on trying to get more electric cars on the road, so that's how they perceive they can bring down CO2 quickest.
Also, I agree with what you're saying, Robin, that we want to make sure we're at least somewhat prepared for an increase in electric vehicles. Can't move to Amador. There's no charging stations there. Yeah.
Jim, I wouldn't leave out this building either, because even though there's charging stations at the parking garage, I guess that's where they are, right?
Yeah.
I think this is an ideal location to possibly have them too.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
With the cities having priority versus the other cities. So.
Thank you for that.
I think we did at one time last October when we discussed it. We talked about between 3 and 10 possible stations, one in each city, so that's 5, and potentially 5 in the unincorporated county. I see this as a starting point, and yes, Richard, you're right. We could build on it, and especially with this Tesla information, you know, there's potential where, you know, we could allow Tesla to foot the bill and put a number of these things out there.
Mr. Chairman, I would support moving forward with a pilot program. I'm not sure that I would limit it to 3. I think we could probably muster enough money to make sure that the county had an opportunity to consider installation at one of the county facilities, and this building would be a good example.
I would.
And I also would want to make sure that, to Lynn Morgan's point, that public access is a principal component, that these don't end up in private parking lots, at least these associated with the pilot program, don't end up at private lots that aren't available to the general public. And then give the municipalities first shot at location, selecting the location or coordinating the location with private parties if that's in fact the best place to put them.
Are you talking about the pilot program as he states it, or a pilot program going through Tesla and seeing if we can make that work?
Well, if Jim can figure out a way to get these installed for free, then that changes the whole program. But
right.
I have a hunch that Tesla may bite on a couple of locations, but
I think they've bitten on a lot over in Shenandoah Valley already, Plymouth and Shenandoah Valley.
So I'm talking about the program as outlined here. If Jim can come up with a Tesla product to augment our own program, that's fine. I don't know that I would. I guess I'm not ready to
jump on the Tesla bandwagon and hope that Tesla carries the day here. I think the Air District needs to do its own thing, and if we can bring Tesla along, so be it. That'd be my approach.
I'd be happy with the pilot as stated here as a number two option if number one doesn't work with Tesla. If we can get it for free, I would sure go that direction first. If we can get as many as we can installed for free, and then if not, then work with our own pilot to create additional stations.
Yep. Well, you pretty much stated that, Jim. That's how you were going to proceed.
That's the way I would recommend proceeding is, working with the pilot project, keeping in mind that we've got some new information from Tesla as of today, see what comes to fruition with that. If it doesn't lead anywhere, then we have the budget as outlined here to proceed.
Or as Robin said, even if the Tesla thing does come through but not to a sufficient number or something,
mm-hmm.
then we would combine the Tesla grant or whatever with this pilot project.
I'm one of those that suspects Tesla may not be going concern in 5 years. So I'm not really excited about hitching my wagon to Tesla when there are so many other manufacturers turning a profit making electric vehicles. If the board feels Tesla is the way to go, that way that's fine. But I'm not in that camp. Thanks.
I'm not necessarily a Tesla lover, but I was just told at a dinner the other night that Tesla's coming out with about a $40,000 electric car now, which is much cheaper than what they've come out with originally. So,
but if losing money on those too.
Okay, so now I'm unclear. Where are we going here?
But even if we went with Tesla and they paid for it, if it's a dual charging station, it'll still work for Teslas as well as every other make and model of electric car, correct?
Yes.
Right.
So are we really at a loss? I mean, we're not really locked into anything, are we?
At least of my knowledge of Tesla's program as it stands right now, I wouldn't think so, but I will look into it further.
I would suggest that we try to get them to put in some of those stations at their expense rather than us, and then we can build other stations with the money that we have. And at the very least, have some Tesla stations and then whatever we want to build.
Mm-hmm.
What's the Air District's role in the Tesla station? I mean, the reality is the reason we're talking about this is because we have money available for grant programs.
Right.
Related to air quality. Now what we're talking about is more of a facilitation role. Bring the city of Sutter Creek, in my case, and Tesla to the same table to discuss the placement of a Tesla facility in the city of Sutter Creek. What's the Air District's role in that? It's not our money. We're not spending any money on it now, so I don't really see it as an Air District program.
It becomes
a waste of your time at that point.
All it is an application. That's my point. That's what Mark said. It's as simple as just calling them and seeing if they're receptive, filing the application.
I mean, the city manager can submit that application just as easily as Jim, and there doesn't seem to be any role for the Air District at that point. If we're going to go with the Tesla situation or the Tesla program, the Air District doesn't need to be in that loop.
Yeah, I think, and again, it's just based upon my knowledge as of today of the Tesla program, but my feeling is that, like, for example, if this board decided that there's a priority for a charging station right here in this parking lot, and we agree that the Air District will fund $5,000, if we were able to get Tesla to put in their charging stations, then we could use that $5,000 for maybe a different location, someplace where Tesla wouldn't put one in. But
If Tesla says, no, we don't like that location, then we have the budget from the Air District to put one in here because we've determined it to be a priority.
You know,
so that's my approach.
A question I'd have is, you know, we're looking at how much for how many charging stations, $5,000 a station if we do them. And I think about, okay, they want to have a zillion electric cars in California. Unless the public pay, unless I pay for everybody, or we pay for everybody else's electric charging station, how's it going to go forward? Who's going to pay that cost? It should be almost like a gas station. You go in there and you pay for what you get. We're doing free charging stations, three, four of them, whatever.
I think we crossed that hurdle about three meetings ago.
I'm still having a problem with it.
Nobody's talking about paying for power. I know the city of Cedar Creek has no appetite to subsidize power consumption in electric vehicles. Whatever station we end up with will be type that charges the user for power. We've talked about this many times.
I still have heartburn over it.
Yeah. Can you ready for a motion?
Yes.
I move that we move ahead with pilot electrical vehicle charging stations with Jim going through Tesla and utilizing that program, facilitating that program to the areas that want it, and then also working with a grant reimbursement program with the district for 100% of purchase and installation up to $5,000 max after the completion of the grantee's installation and with proper documentation. Total pilot project, that's only going to be three stations. Is that going to be enough?
I figured that would get us started, and we certainly could come back.
Total project budget started out.
I'll second.
Discussion? You're the second?
No.
Okay, Bob? I heard him down the summer. Okay, so we have a motion by Forster and a second by Morgan, or by Simpson. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? I'm going to oppose. So it carries 8-1. 1-0 vote. With that, we'll move on down to item number 6.
7-1.
7-1, right. Wait, I did get one. You're right. Yep, 7-1. My apologies. I did. With that, move on down to item number 6. This is the smoke reduction bin program, pine needle bins.
Pine needle bin program. And try and move through this quickly if possible. But this was discussed previously, and, you know, we have had some issues with dumping of unauthorized materials and also of use by landscapers and yard maintenance companies. But I think the biggest issue right now is the overload of pine needles at the green waste processing facility. We were required to terminate the program slightly early this year in September, and been notified by Vicini Brothers Green Waste Recycling Facility that they can no longer accept any of the pine needles from the district's pine needle bin program. ACES has negotiated green waste disposal at Sierra Wood Waste in Sacramento. However, the per ton disposal cost is $38 a ton, which is more than twice the current disposal cost. ACES will still charge the haul charge to service the pine needle bins. However, they have offered to waive the transfer charge from Buena Vista to the Sierra Wood Waste facility. So with that, I think we need to give some direction to staff on how to proceed forward with this program.
So what does it mean to waive the charge from Buena Vista to Sierra Wood? They're not going to charge us at all?
Yeah, ACES has offered to waive the transfer, so the material gets collected in the bins out in the community. It gets commingled at the Buena Vista transfer location, loaded onto the big 50-foot transfer trucks, and then transferred down to Sacramento. It's that fee, right, Paul? Yeah.
Uh, the transport down to Sacramento or the commingling and loading?
No, the haul charge, which includes the, you know, the offloading and what they need to do at the facility, that still will be charged. That's the haul charge. But it's just simply the cost for them to put it on a big transfer truck and take it to Sacramento.
Well, you're aware, Jim, and probably the rest of you are, that the Pine Needle Bin program is extremely popular in my district because there are a number of people who actually lately have been complaining to me again who have compromised lungs because there has been some burning going on. On the other hand, I know we have the letter that we'll be discussing later on the agenda. You know, so it's a real conflict, and I sympathize with the challenge you have on that issue, Jim, because, you know, you've got people wanting burning and people not wanting burning. So it's a real issue, but the bins are extremely popular, and up in my district, we'd like to see more.
How much is in your discretionary fund?
Well, I'm willing to help out, you bet. I would definitely do that. I don't think my discretionary fund's going to help much, but...
No.
So, Jim, it's about a four-month program now?
Yeah, it seems like...
So it'll be down to 60 days if you cost doubling.
Yeah, if you look at the disposal costs, it definitely is going to limit.
I know that's simplistic, but yeah. Probably not too far off.
Probably not too far. Probably not too far. Yeah.
I might take flack for this, but I think this program really originated as a pine needle program upcountry. Expanded from there. I know the city of Sutter Creek has benefited from having a bin at the fire station for a couple of years now, and it's been very popular too. But what I don't want to see is the cost of this program mushrooming out of control. And if that means eliminating bins in some places so that the core program can stay intact or perpetuate, then you know, I would think that eliminating a bin in Sutter Creek would be a good place to start if it allowed, you know, if that was a way to offset costs and allow the program to survive upcountry. Now, having said all of that, we still have the major problem of trash and abuse of those upcountry facilities. That's the one problem we don't have in Sutter Creek because it's right there by the fire station and it's crawling with firemen all day long.
Right.
So, you know, I don't pretend to have a solution for that, and I'm not, as much as we've discussed it, I don't know that there really is a good solid solution for that particular problem. And I'm concerned about allowing the program to move forward until we really come up with a viable solution for that problem. So, on the one hand, you know, if it's a money thing and eliminating the bin in Sutter Creek were a way to solve or partially solve that problem, then so be it. But I think the bigger problem really is how to deal with the abuse, and I'd like to hear a solution to that before.
Well, I appreciate the offer, Robin. How much of a problem is it? Because, you know, my experience with it is really just on Woodland Road. And we really have no problem because we've got a diligent neighbor who monitors it. And so is it like on Silver Drive or something?
Yeah, it's Silver and it's a Taboo and Pine Acres. Those are the two locations where we know that we're getting dumped on. And we're getting, you know, I mean... Yeah, just an extraordinary amount of material. And I was up there probably about a month ago, and I was on, I think I was doing a smoke complaint, And I was talking to someone, and the guy said, oh, yeah, I see the guy with the landscaping business. He pulls up almost every day right after dark and dumps his stuff in there. So I mean, I haven't personally seen it, but I've heard a lot of that feedback about Silver Drive and about Pine Acres. Those are the problems. And, you know, we don't have that problem quite to that extent at Lockwood, obviously not at Sutter Creek. And then what you were referring to is a neighborhood bin. That's kind of a different arrangement.
And yeah. And our diligent person, you know, has put up signs, no commercial yard waste.
Yeah.
I mean, she whatever. So, yeah. But it is a small area.
You know, one problem I do see that too, if your disposal cost is going to double, I mean, this thing's going to, we're going to have diminishing returns or really, really quick. And also, I see your ACES has been gracious enough to offer away the transfer charge from Buena Vista to Sierra Wood facility. It's probably still got to come out of, you know, your ACES profits or out of the customer base somehow. It's still a cost. So I know Lockwood does like the having the bins available, but it's looking like there's a few cracks in the egg, put it that way.
Well, what's your proposed budget then? Because just this year, running through what the end of August, we spent about 46, was it? And the year before, we spent 70. If we go just on what we spent this year, it's going to be and run through August. It's going to be much greater than 46.
Well, and again, you know, I think that's the key to it. If we decide that this is a program, you know, that will be continued next year, if we set a budget at whatever, name a number, 40,000, 50,000, whatever the number is, then we can manage the program within the constraint of that budget. Now it's going to mean probably taking away Silver Drive or Pine Acres, but to the extent we can, we'll work to carry the program as far as we can with the budget we have. But I think there is validity to Director Peter's point that, you know, at some point we're going to hit the tipping point where we're spending money and it's really chiseling away at our, now we came up with this program because of the reserve money, but at some point if we maintain it, we're going to chip away to the point where we can't anymore. And then the program will have to be stopped. So I think, you know, we have to look at that as kind of the broader picture beyond just this next year.
Well, I'm going to condition my vote on that we eliminate whatever problem stations there are. When you told me at the one station that you had to haul away, have a large stump hauled away,
yeah,
because the property owner called you and complained about it, that's a problem we shouldn't have to be dealing with. So if the sites are encouraging that kind of dumping behavior and the commercial landscapers to come in because there's no supervision at all on the site, at least on some of the other sites, there's some kind of implied supervision over it.
Oh, and something else you may want to look at too is basically the how condensed the area is. I mean, if you got 5-10 acre lots, probably not as big a factor generally is if you have smaller lots, as far as the need, and also an interest of seeking creative solutions. Using some of the good language here. Would it be legally possible to approach, like, maybe the Forest Service, which I don't think they would. I mean, get them doing that could probably be impossible. But the Forest Service or Sierra Pacific, and just, quite honestly, if he took a bunch of pine needles out and dumped them in the forest somewhere, they'd rot. Pure and simple. And you probably wouldn't have all the haul costs, all other issues. I don't know if that's something that legally could do, or that would that be unauthorized dumping as far as, like, a dump, you know, the state of California come down on us?
Yeah, that could be problematic because it would probably trigger unlawful
CEQA
dumping. Yeah. But along your question, one thing that I've been looking at is down at the landfill. We have a large area of the landfill that was stripped to make room for what was going to be the phase four section, and that area has remained bare clay for years and years and years, and it's developed huge erosion rills and has a real, ultimately it's going to have to be addressed. And one thought I had is if we could take pine needles, grind them up, and then blow them out onto this vast area down there to serve as a erosion control device. Now, that would have to be approved by the Regional Water Board because they're very sensitive about us putting anything in or around the landfill. But that was a thought that I had, is if pine needles at some point in the future could maybe be used as an erosion control best management practice. So that's something, you know, that I'd like to look into.
Jim, and I don't think we should be punishing Sutter Creek for following the rules. If we're going to downsize, we should take the bad actors away.
Well, I think the Pine Grove, or in particular the Pine Acres area, has a lot of pine trees. Not saying that Sutter Creek doesn't, but maybe since Paul Molinelli is here, maybe one of the bins could be placed, if Aces is going to haul it, at the transfer station. I don't know if you have the room, but then there would be supervision, and they're going to pick them up anyway, so maybe that would be a possible place, but I can't make that call for Pine Grove.
Did you hear that, Paul?
Huh?
Yeah.
He did, oh, but he doesn't want to.
He heard you loud and clear.
Robin, I wanted to correct one thing. I believe the fire department in Sutter Creek is paying for that bin. So I don't think...
Now. Oh, okay.
Are they paying to extend the season? Yeah, but during the regular season, I think the air district picks it up, correct? Yeah, they extend the season.
Oh, okay.
Would you repeat your...
I was just suggesting because the Pine Acres bin is being abused, and it'd be nice to have it in a location where there's some level of supervision. Perhaps it could be placed at the transfer station, ACES transfer station, in Pine Grove. That would service the Pine Grove area. That is, if you're going to haul them to begin with, I mean, they're actually bringing it to you rather than you having to go out and pick it up. I don't know if that works for you or not.
The first thing that comes to my mind is currently we charge people to bring it there. So would we have to eliminate charging people and just allow them to bring it, which is, that's just a matter of economics. It's not a something, not a hurdle we can overcome.
Well, they have
to
put it in a specific bin.
There was at one point a voucher system. The county provided people upon demand, if I'm not mistaken, a voucher. They would get it and they would bring their material to our facility. It somehow got out of hand. Jim, and you might remember more than I, but it worked.
Program, well, it started out okay, but then it did get terribly out of control, and the cost just went through the roof, and it had to be canceled.
They were bartering sales of the vouchers, swapping. It got out of hand in that respect.
Paul, you could do what Comanche does, and the voucher system works very well.
Did.
And they go through their community association to distribute the vouchers. So
some ideas that we would like to propose to the county. We're working with an ad hoc committee on another issue, and we thought that would be a place where we'd like to bring some proposals that might help with the problem you're talking about today.
Green waste.
Yeah, and among other things.
Okay.
So I guess the question is how much we want to budget, or any at all.
We're mid-budget right now.
I'm sorry, say it.
We're mid-budget year, right? So
this is for next year.
Well, Well, we're not in the budget cycle right now, so we've already budgeted money for this program for 17-18, right?
Up until June 30th, yeah.
Right.
Sure. So we're mid-cycle.
Right.
Right.
So what decision are we faced with right now? I mean, we already have a number dialed into the budget. Unless the board directs you otherwise, that's all you have to work with for this program.
Right. So, yeah, so if we started, say we started this program again on May 1st, by June 30th, so that's 2 months, we would then be out of budget.
But before then, we will be approving a new budget.
Well, yes.
Then the question really becomes...
But I was kind of trying to get us thinking and perhaps, you know, authorizing the direction of this program over the next year, which in that, I mean, two budget years. So I'm talking about the end of this budget year up to June 30th, and then also what we're going to do starting July 1.
I would think that...
Those are two separate questions.
Yeah, exactly. I would think that with only 2 months remaining in this, 2 months of program operation remaining in this budget year, that with the X dollars you have left, manage it as you see fit. We'll have a discussion on what to do next budget year before that operation starts up again. So... That'll give us a couple of months to give you a couple of months to really drill down on the issue of abuse,
mm-hmm.
and come up with a solution for that. Because if there's no rational solution for that problem, the program may have to be terminated anyway, notwithstanding budget.
But in between now and then, they should be looking for those sites to identify new locations where there could be some pseudo-supervision.
That's
there.
My point. Between now and then, there's time, but we don't have to discuss the budget question until our normal budget cycle.
Yeah.
By then, you'll have a solution or won't. That may answer the budget question in and of itself.
Well, I agree, and I would like... I should let you...
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well... Again, I've said before what a critical program this is to many lung-compromised people in my district. And I would hate to see it terminated, although financially it's not sustainable. I understand that. I would like you to see if there are some sites, as was suggested, that it's just too costly to have them there and to, you know, reduce the number of sites. Or whatever, you know, that's an analysis I would like to see you do and bring back to us before our next budget session.
Okay. One thing I wanted to mention is I know, Director Stimson, you had mentioned about Jackson potentially being a location.
We we had an issue downtown with someone doing a burn pile, and so we're looking into... changing our ordinance as far as burning in the downtown area specifically. And there was discussion of possibly placing a bin at the BC parking lot by Mellon Faze for people to dump yard waste into rather than burn. And so not sure whether that would fit into the budget for Pine Needle Bin program, but that was just an option we're looking into.
And that's kind of analogous to the Sutter Creek Bend, except that my concern would be the Busey parking lot would be unattended and could be some problem.
Probably be the same way.
Yeah, but could be a real problem.
Unless we found another spot, you know, close to the fire department, wherever.
Yeah. So, yeah, and kind of, you know, I guess... My thought was a little broader, too, in that, you know, there seems to be some real interest on the board of directors to maintain and perhaps even expand this program. There seems to be some interest on the board of directors to phase this program back and potentially even eliminate it. And before we get to May 1st, we get calls, you know, hey, are you going to do your Pine Needle Bins? When are you going to put them out? I was hoping to have a little advance kind of idea as to what direction we're heading. And I totally understand that if what the direction is now is to look at the program with the look for solutions to reduce the problem areas, I can do that. But I just wanted to be aware that if there was a direction one way or another, that I get clear direction on which way to go.
I think your last thoughts were right on the money. And the other thing, keep looking for alternative uses. As I told you before, that when I was back east in Atlanta, they're using the pine needles for ground cover in place of rocks and other things. So
a lot of places are using them now.
Yeah.
Another thing that occurred to me, Jim, is, you know, that right now it seems like the program is kind of on an unsustainable trajectory, so you could pare it back. But another thing is, maybe what we can do is provide a subsidy to those individuals that want to eliminate their pine needles. That is, we don't necessarily pay for it all. They still have to pay some of it too, and that way we can make the program more sustainable out into the future. I don't know if that'll work or not, but
kind of a share of cost.
Yeah. That way you can stretch it a little further. I don't know if that's going to work or not, but
and something else that helps. I'm sure you do a lot. We do a lot of RAs. If you get people to break dry needles, cover needles, burn them in the dry, it makes just a huge difference. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you can't regulate common sense.
So we'll bring it back next time in March with some potential solutions to the problem.
And also, I've got to go, so I'm going to step down now. We've got this. Oh, yes. Thank you, Director Forster. I neglected public comment. Any members of the public like to comment?
Not here all this time. I knew you wanted to say something.
Got to say something.
Brother with the Simi Brothers. Center Creek, beautiful bend. That's the only bend I will accept. Got no pine needles in it, no garbage in it, no nothing. And if Jackson does the same, I'll accept it. So that's two that Paul won't have to haul to Sacramento.
Love it. That'd be great.
But I just can't do those upcountry ones. They're just Calaveras County's got the same problem. Just they won't burn. You can't do nothing with them. They don't rot. But Cedar Creek's, and if Jackson can police one, I'll accept it, no problem. Year round, if they want to, like I guess Cedar Creek, the fire department's sponsoring that one at the moment.
We're still in the beginning stages of this, and we'll look for a policeable location.
The dilution's a solution, and Cedar Creek's dilutes the heck out of pine needles and stuff that we get, you know, on an everyday basis out of the other places. So.
Herb, do you think if you could do a pilot program and grind some of those pine needles up, and you think there'd be any market for it?
I don't know about the market. I have people come in there continuously. Nobody ever wants to buy them.
I'm just thinking of like oak leaves and things like that have a lot of acid in them. The pine needles have a lot of acid. They may be able to stop regrowth of vegetation.
Yeah, I don't know.
He tried those wattles, for erosion control on pine needles. Remember, didn't you?
They did. No, I didn't know. Mine's got the little sticks in it. I still saw a lot of those.
Oh, I thought yours had pine needles in there.
No, no pine needles. A guy in Calaveras County, he tried the pine needles and they didn't work.
And they won't absorb nothing.
No. And they wouldn't attract. See, mine, the sticks are all up to a year old, so they've got carbon and stuff on them, and that's what attracts the clays and stuff to the sticks.
Well,
thank you. Kind of solution, but yeah, like if we can get a deal with water quality and do them down there to landfill and just spread them on the bank, that'd probably do you for 2 or 3 years. I don't know. They're pretty hard to work with.
Add one thing. Only because it came up, Jim and I had talked some time ago about grinding, taking some of the material that we get and grind it and use it for. We talked about today, we are going to rent a grinder. We're going to attempt to grind the material that we get.
and see what we get to see how marketable it is or what its uses are. So we are going to try that, and we're going to take the material that comes in, which will include pine needles, and what we're going to do is mix it with lumber chips so we may get a better product. But we are going to do that. Worked on it today, as a matter of fact.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you for offering to cover the transport fee or cost.
And we have other things that we'd like to talk to the county about.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you. Is that enough direction, Jim?
I think so. I think okay. We got direction.
With that, I'm going to step down as chair, and Bob, you want to take over?
Sure. Here comes Mr. Chair, I have to leave as well, so.
I'll lose the gavel.
Yeah, really.
Minnie, we still have a quorum, don't we? I leave as well?
Do we have a quorum?
Yeah, we're okay.
I think so.
Not going to stay for the draft policy?
I must go.
Okay, so we're moving on here.
Okay, so we're moving on to item number 7, draft reserve policy.
Yeah, and you have in there a memo that I drafted up a policy in response to the discussion we had at the October 17th meeting, and we talked about the cash reserve at the Air District and how one time it was growing. We've implemented all these programs that growth has stopped, and so then the discussion was about, well, what is our policy? We didn't have a policy for managing the cash reserve. So I came up with kind of a two-level policy here that, not less than 25% of a three-year average for the most recent three-year period of the operating budget of the district. In the event cash reserve falls below 25%, an emergency meeting board of directors will be called within 30 days to determine the low cash reserve, determining modifications to the current budget expenditure plan to stay within that 25%. Then the second part is B, not more than 200% of a three-year average. Again, in the event we go above 200%, we'll have an emergency meeting called within 30 days to make modifications to the current budget's expenditure plan to designate an amount of the budget necessary to bring the cash reserve down to the desired range, and we'll encumber funds until funds have been expended for the designated purpose. So that's what I came up with. I did do some research and talk to Tacy, the auditor here, and got some feedback from her on it, and also got some information from other air districts.
So just to be clear, item B, you're saying not more than 200% of a three-year average of the budget?
Of our operating budget.
Operating budget.
Yeah. Okay. So if our operating budget is $500,000, then it would be 200% of that.
I don't know. We need an emergency meeting if we're over budget, do we?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I wrote that.
Party.
Right.
I actually, it's funny because I was rereading this after I had stayed up, I think, late looking at this, and I was like, why do we need an emergency meeting for either of these? It just the next board meeting probably would suffice. So,
especially if we're over budget.
Yeah. So if there was agreement, I could scratch the emergency meeting and just change it to the next available board of directors meeting.
I think that.
So would you have a motion?
I will move approval of the investment policy with the amendment to part A and B to eliminate the need for emergency meetings.
Second.
All in favor?
Under discussion. Now, Robin's comments before he left, this was his issue.
Oh.
And I don't know why he didn't say it. He thought the not less than 25% should be not less than 50%. Now, to me, that seems a little high, especially since our budgeted money seems pretty stable coming from DMV.
Yeah, I felt that the 50% was too much also. I mean, I could live with 30 or 35 if you wanted to up it some. I'm really pretty happy the way it's written.
Well, I am too, and I definitely think 50%.
Well,
then you get accused of having money, just collecting money.
Which we've been accused of for the last 3 years.
Yeah. That's the problem that we've been having is we have too much.
Right. So
we're having all these spending programs.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
So what was the minimum back then?
Didn't have a policy.
There's no policy. Yeah, that was the problem.
Started 25.
And we started 25.
Call the question.
Okay. Have a motion?
I have a motion and a second.
And a second?
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay. And then,
so, item number 8, City of Jackson CCAD special request.
Yes, and this is regarding the CCAD program, City County Agency Diesel Engine Replacement Program, and City of Jackson is interested in obtaining a chipper for its public work crews. However, when we first looked into this, we didn't find that they had an existing non-compliant EPA engine as a replacement, so we really didn't get anywhere. As an alternative, we worked with the fire department, and we did get a piece of equipment for the fire department. It was quite a bit less than what we normally were spending on this program. It was about $9,000 that we funded the City of Jackson. So we've been requested to consider the Air District's grant assistance for a chipper to be used by the City Public Works crew. The chipper will reduce the dump truck haul loads the city is currently required to perform, and as a result will reduce the adverse air quality impacts. So I wanted to bring this forward, and I know you and I had discussed it.
Right. And reducing the emissions in the City of Jackson would be impacted greatly, I think, by the chipper. Discussion that we've had today points in that direction. And I think it would be a good fit for the program, even though we don't have one that we're swapping out. About it.
Do we have any other applications for those funds, Jim? No, as a matter of fact, I'm sorry. No, we have been very successful with this program, and let me take a look at in here. Okay, and back in your the back of your packet, you've got a sheet that looks like this, and it shows you the distributions of the funds that we did, and so we've basically, with the ones we have in progress currently, we will have expended $147,122.15 out of $169,000 that was approved. So our remaining budget in this category is $21,877.85. So whatever we do, that's what we have to work with, that number.
What did you say was the approved amount of money for this program?
$169,000.
So, Bob, would that should go a long way in purchasing a chipper, right?
Almost
$22,000?
The total that I was given was $17,000 for one that we were looking at. And Today's date, we've only used $6,400 of the whole program money for Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in all fairness, and it would help with the air quality. And
one thing I did want to mention is the way this CCAD program was set up is we funded, I think, 75% up to a total of $25,000 previously.
Okay.
So, wasn't that how we did it?
Yeah,
75
for
tier 4.
Yeah, that's the whole premise.
Yeah. So we would probably, using that, we would look at 75% if your number's below.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to look at this as a precedent either. I mean, we have a very small amount of money left, and we just have to make a one-time exception for this, being that they don't have a one to turn in.
Right. And if you have any technical specifications on the one you're looking at, if you could send it to us or get it to us, it'd be helpful.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will get it.
Were there any others, Jim, that we turned down because they didn't qualify?
No, we actually...
initial period?
No, we actually... we're able to go back and do a second project with Amador Water Agency. So that gives you an idea. We went through our whole list.
Okay.
And then, yeah.
Jim, you mentioned that chipping, I don't know, saves time or money or something. Why is that in the hauling part of it? Is it because it's more compact at that point?
Emissions. I think it's because it's going to reduce those truck loads back and forth.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
So they're currently hauling truckloads.
And the backhoe to load them in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so how does chipping it, I mean, just because it makes it a more homogeneous...
chipping it and leaving it, right?
Less loads.
You're leaving it up there.
We'd be leaving it in place where chipping's going on and stockpiling at the courtyard.
It's a portable chipper, right?
Yes.
You haul it to the pile.
It would be right behind the truck.
You're not going to haul it at all.
Yeah, I think that's the plan.
Yeah, so a lot less hauling.
I'd move to approve the allocation of up to 75% of the cost of a chipper for the city of Jackson with a one-time exception for the city not turning in a used chipper as a creditor.
Second. No, I'd second that.
Okay, I have a motion to approve and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Thank you.
Okay. And then we go on to the APCO's update. And I can move through this real quickly. The first thing you have is a list of requests from the California Air Resources Board to the Amador Air District. And this is regarding a program they have, which is called CEDARS. CEIDARS, it stands for California Admissions Inventory Development and Reporting System. More than anything, this is to make you aware of the type of things that come up, and these simple little requests turn into just these mountains, and you can see the number of requests listed on this sheet, and the fact that they kept digging deeper and deeper and deeper into this program, which we had never previously, the Air District didn't have to do anything with. But it kept getting more and more, and we did have to bring in Ray to do some work on this, and there was some cost associated with it. So I just wanted to make this board aware of this type of expense and the fact that you know, we get these requests, and actually they're not requests, they're demands. They tell us we must provide this. And it got fairly contentious with the Air Resources Board regarding this particular issue, because I felt like they were coming on really heavy-handed and they were just demanding too much. And unfortunately, they didn't like me stating that, and they got even meaner with us, and they got a bigger stick. And so So we ended up having to provide all this information. We are in compliance. I really want to acknowledge Herminia, who has learned this entire CEDARS database program, and she's done a great job of providing, well, I don't know if she's learned the whole thing, but she's learned a lot of it. And she's done a great job of kind of getting us out of the penalty box on this. So more than anything, I just wanted to make you aware of this and the fact that there's expenses associated with it.
So did Ampine have to pay almost $197,000?
No, they did not. And that was a real trigger point on this. ARB invoiced them. ARB sent the invoice, and then ARB blamed us and said it was our fault for not providing the information. And I'm telling you, this we could go on all night, but I won't. But the problem was is we said, well, what is it that we need to provide? And ARB says, we can't tell you. We'll just tell you when you're wrong, basically. You know, we can't tell you what to provide. So they kept, you know, beating us with this thing, and it resulted in Ampine getting billed. But no, it was an invalid bill. They weren't required to pay it. But they sure got pretty worked up over it. Ampine did. They were very upset about getting
when
that.
When they're that upset, we ought to be taking something like that to our legislators.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree.
Let us know if that scenario happens again.
Okay. Would this be something we'd maybe run through RCRC or
I think
folks?
You'd want to take it to our assemblyman first.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And
okay.
So ARB finally backed off of Ampine needing to pay that money?
Yeah, they rescinded the invoice, but then see, it started as a Buena Vista biomass, just a simple little question, and then it blew up into this big, huge thing with Buena Vista biomass, even though they've been closed for years.
Yeah.
Then it blew up into this Ampine thing, and then they blew it up into every source we have in the county. They wanted all this data on every source in the county, and that's why you see that line going all the way down with all those requests. And, Herminia had to basically respond to every single one of those.
Well, most of this is generated by these departments being given direction to go after and get as much revenue as you can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Why were they interested in Ampine? Because they also have a biomass capability there as well?
No, it's because of Ampine's emissions. And it kind of relates to what Ray was talking about earlier. Ampine is a source that produces X number of tons per year, so they're in this higher category. And so they felt like because of that, Ampine was subject to this special fee. And if you notice the first, you know, back in April 5th, 2016, I had been told by staff that they weren't subject to this non-vehicular source fee. But then all of a sudden, they did a 180. I think you're right, Richard. I think it's because they were trying to get money. So they basically did a 180, and they then put Ampine kind of in the crosshairs.
So this is just from burning natural gas and the fuel, the power, you know, the
their processes and their emissions, because they have a lot of volatiles that they emit too, with their glues and all that stuff.
What was the justification for Ampine being exempt from the fee?
Didn't meet the threshold. The threshold, yeah. Yeah.
Reporting now,
yeah, and it's a really complicated thing, but it really ran into some real money and some real work on our part, and I wanted this board to be aware, because that's the kind of stuff we get asked to do. So I can keep moving through and go wood stove change out program. And I think you have, a brief memo on that. As of January 9th, 2018, Air District has paid a total of $44,838.43 to 23 participants. And we have number 24 and 25 are being finalized in the next couple weeks. So we will have essentially expended the whole $50,000 that was budgeted for this program. And I would say this program turned out very successful. So that's the wood stove change out. And then let's see, the CCAD program we already discussed, and we looked at the budget and the funding for that. In your packet is the financials through January 11th, 2018. And then the last thing is the correspondence from Mr. Cannon, and you have in there his letter and then my response to Mr. Cannon.
I have a comment on that. I tended to agree with Mr. Cannon, and that's when you got all riled up about it, Jim, but I appreciate your zeal and because I wanted to burn some stuff over the three-day weekend, too. So did our CAO, Tuck Eide. But we were restricted. But one thing Mr. Kapai, in his presentation, it started off in the presentation, state delegated the enforcement of federal and state air quality rules to the counties and local air districts. So, but I guess in the next line he says this means that the burden of complying with the air quality rules is shifted from the state and federal to the counties and air districts, which means we have a very limited scope of where we can not agree with the state's ruling or decision that today or tomorrow is a non-burn day.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I'll just read to you out of our own rules, a rule that we currently have. It says the air pollution control officer may issue a special permit to authorize the use of an open outdoor fire on no burn days as designated by ARB when denial of such permit would threaten imminent and substantial economic loss and when downwind metropolitan areas are forecasted by the ARB to achieve the ambient air quality standards. So you can see, by virtue of our own rules, and by the way, this rule was taken out of state statute, by virtue of our own rule and state statute, we're very limited on overruling those burn day decisions.
You don't know how tempted I was to light a fire up yesterday anyway, but I was a good boy.
Well, I think yesterday was a burn day, wasn't it? Yeah,
it was.
Yesterday was a burn day.
Yesterday was a burn
day. You said all three days were non-burn days.
Oh. It changed.
You gotta call the number.
I didn't even call because you said that all three days were non-burn
days. Jim, write them one of those up. Write them a day.
2236246 is the burn day.
I have it in my phone.
I know. Can't win.
Okay, and that's everything.
That's it.
Yep.
Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.